Welcome to United Bodies, a podcast about the lived experience of health. I'm Kendall Seismeyer, your host. Welcome to the second half of United Bodies, where we're focused on building the world we need. This is the fun part, I think. A huge part of imagining a better world is about imbuing our world with joy. And there's nothing that makes me feel more joy than laughter. I love to laugh, and I particularly love to laugh about my own problems. This is what I think they call coping. Laughter is contagious, and it literally extends our lives. Laughter can also help us reckon with circumstances we can't control, like the ones our bodies put us in. Bodies can be embarrassing, and laughing about them helps us break down the taboo. So today I'm talking to essayist and humorist Samantha Irby, who has made me laugh out loud about her body in ways that are resonant and deep and silly and embarrassing and like a salve on the soul. In this conversation, we'll learn how we can all borrow her talent for ourselves in our own times of need. Samantha Irby is a New York Times bestselling author and the author of 4 essay collections. Her latest book, Quietly Hostile, is out now. Sam, welcome to United Bodies, and thank you so much for joining me.
Kendall, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to talk about my horrible body.
Me too. So I have to start the conversation where I found you, which was, I think I first read your book, Meaty. And as I was telling you before we hit record, I'm pretty sure my mom got it. And I'm pretty sure that she got it for me because I think at some level saw poop as a topic of conversation. And as someone who was, you know, basically born with a liver disease and has had many, many liver issues /2 liver transplants, poop has been a real centerpiece of my life. So from like one poop girl to another, I feel seen, I feel heard.
Thank you.
And my mom was clearly onto something, is what I'm saying.
That's the highest compliment anyone could ever give me. All the butt problem girlies who reach out, I mean, are obviously not that I pick favorites, but they're my favorites. So that is thrilling to me. And thank your mom. Tell her I love her. Moms fucking love me. So I'm sure she'll want to adopt me as soon as you tell her.
I'm sure she will. But like the Moms Love Me brand, is like, that's a strong one. That's that you can really go places with that.
Yeah. I've even as a kid, I was like, you know, not really in a suck up-y way, more in a loser way, like the one who's like at the sleepover, like, what's Jan doing downstairs in the kitchen? And then I'll go like find out.
So. And Jan is like so excited that anyone's asking her how she is.
I'm like, how's your day, girl? How's your menopause getting you down? I know. You know.
I know a thing about bodies too.
I'm only 8, but I can imagine.
Yeah, I love that. So in an excerpt from a book that I can't wait to read, which is Listening in the Dark, Women Reclaiming the Power of Intuition, you wrote, I have an instinct for what will make people laugh, or at the very least, what will make people laugh at me. I thought that was so interesting that you had this instinct growing up. When did you first discover that instinct? Do you remember the moment where you're like, I got it?
I think instinct is me being generous to myself. I definitely learned early, like I was poor, fat, had fucked up teeth. My hair was never like right. I didn't have the right clothes. And I learned very early how to use humor as a deflecting tactic. It takes the sting out of what somebody else says if you say it first. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're like, well, look at my holy shoes. I mean, that is a terrible example. But, you know, if you point out.
You're so funny.
If you point out what's going on before someone else can, then at least, I mean, for the sensitive among us, I know there are people who can get roasted and don't care. I definitely cared. And there's no way to win if you're like, don't make fun of me. That doesn't help. So I very quickly learned how to spin things into a joke. And now as an adult, I mean, I just, you know, and poop jokes always get people going when it comes to like, you know, trying to make yourself Teflon against what other people might say about you to your face. Humor was the thing that worked and kept working.
Mm. Yeah. And so you got better and better and better at it with more and more use of it. Now it's part of a huge part of like how you make money.
Yes. I mean, at this point, it is the way that I make money, which I never would have guessed that like my anti teasing tactics would cash in. I didn't know I'd be able to cash in on those.
Your coping mechanisms would.
Yes. If only I could monetize the other shit I do to cope. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. You've said that there's something medicative about taking something that makes me feel like garbage and churning it through my interior joke machine until it becomes something I can laugh at. What does that process look like? Is it intentional? Have there been layers to like, okay, now I have this new thing that I'm dealing with, or I have to figure out how to make this funny?
Well, so 9 months ago, I was diagnosed with OCD, which I thought, I mean, you know, just like everyone else, I'm like, oh, I don't wash my hands that much. You know what I mean? I was just thinking about like the light switches and the faucets of it all. And my psychiatrist was like, shut the fuck up. All you do is ruminate on the same thoughts over and over and over. My first inclination is to just beat myself up and just replay whatever humiliating situation over and over and over again. And like, we all wallow, right? Like, we all get down in the dumps and kind of like settle in and feel bad. And so I definitely do that. But to pull myself out of it, I just have to find the nugget of humor, even if I kind of create it in my mind, right? Mm. Just finding any piece of anything to laugh at the circumstance has been so helpful in preventing me from swirling down the drain with like negative thoughts. So I still get them, but I pull myself out of them by being like, you know, that's actually fucking stupid and she's a bitch, so who cares? And then I'll be like, oh, yes, self, who cares?
Yes, we're rising out. We're rising out of this.
We're laughing at her. Who cares?
Very interesting. So it starts kind of as a coping mechanism for you personally and then kind of becomes this thing like, oh, maybe if I'm responding to this and this is how I'm dealing with something, this can be helpful to other people.
Yeah, it lends itself to like if I mean, this is such a like gross therapy word, but if I can reframe a thing in my mind and that thing could be amusing or useful or whatever to another person, that is a good way to find things to write about. Or things that I feel are worthy of being included in a book. A lot of stuff I should just journal and burn so no one can read it. But occasionally a thing will happen and I'll be like, oh yeah, okay, here's what's funny about that. Here's what I can say about that. Here's how I will fill a 5,000-word essay about this thing. But I always have to find the humor in it first.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the process by which it becomes like not just your problem, but then a communal problem that then you can like really sell as a antidote to said problem. I also think there's something just so devastating about life that it's the laughing to keep from crying thing.
Yes.
There's that dynamic of well, this is all really serious. And in order to not just completely become a catatonic ghost of myself, then I have to find some light. I have to create some light. I have to bear witness to some kind of levity of sorts.
It's bleak if you can't do that. It feels, mm-hmm. it's sort of like, well, what's the point?
What's the point? Yeah.
I never want to get back to that place of, you know, what is the point of doing anything? Because everything is terrible. Like it's very seductive, but I feel like it would only lead to a very bad place. So I try to stay out of that.
Yeah. And I think as much as it is available to you, trying to make that decision to choose, I think sometimes you can feel a little guilty or weird about laughing about something so hard, right? But to try to make that choice to not make yourself suffer more, but to help yourself suffer less.
Yes.
It is sometimes a difficult decision, mm-hmm. and is something that sometimes you can feel a little bit weird about. How do you reconcile making fun of really serious, hard things?
Well, I think because I keep the lens firmly trained on myself, because I never want to do harm to anyone or feel as if I'm speaking for people, because I understand that I'm an anomaly. I don't know how many people with horrible bowel diseases think they are worth joking about. I'm sure there are a lot of people who really don't. And so because I never turn the focus anywhere but me, I don't ever feel guilty, because exactly like you said, this is what's gonna get me to tomorrow. Like, this is how I have to deal with it. I read this Christopher Pike book once when I was a kid, and it was about these kids. They were hot, fun high schoolers driving to a haunted house to stay there. Well, they didn't know it was haunted, something. And one of the girls in the book, her father had died. And they were talking about how she was silent and couldn't eat and like just cried. And that image has stuck with me, because there's a piece of me that wishes that I could be that way, that I could withdraw from everything, be totally selfish, and just sit in my pain and, you know, assume that everything is going to work out. People will take care of things. The light bill will get paid. And while I nurse my wounds. And I think partially because I didn't have that option. It was always like, oh, I have to go to work. I had no safety net. My parents died when I was 18. You got to find a way to get your ass up and go to work the next day. And for me, sort of processing my grief and my failures and rejections with humor, with a little levity, approaching life in general with a little levity, has helped me get to work the next day. You know, I didn't have an option. Okay, I'm going to turn all this into jokes, and then eventually turn that into what I do for my life. If I told 18-year-old me that joking about my misfortunes was going to be my career path, I wouldn't believe it. Because truly, it just developed out of a need to find a way to keep going.
That makes a lot of sense. Something I've noticed about your humor is that it is typically about like the uncontrollables, whether that's your body processes to anxiety, to aging, other people's behavior. Do you think that humor gives us a sense of agency over the kind of uncontrollables of life?
Yeah. First of all, that's so astute that you notice that, because that is maybe my biggest struggle. I am not spontaneous. Especially as I'm getting older, I have, like, curdled into the kind of person who's like, who's coming in the house? What was that noise? Where are you going? What's this? Why don't I know how this works? You know, I feel adrift. I think one of the things about getting older, especially in the age in which we live, is there are too many new things to learn, and they all involve technologies that I don't have the skill or interest to become an expert in. I am having a hard time, you know, not knowing a lot of things. And I think having that kind of control is impossible. I would love to control everything. I would love to have a schedule and everyone adheres to it and I know what's happening at all times, but that's not possible. And I think humor at least makes me feel in charge of what's happening to me. So at the very least, it's like I can take a thing that I didn't plan for that was upsetting or jarring or whatever, mm-hmm. and then I can take the reins back by filtering it through like my perspective and then writing about it. It is a way to at least control how the narrative will be in the future, you know?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So typically when we talk about like uncontrollables, the things in my life that feel uncontrollable, typically around my health, right? Like what my body is doing, I feel like...
does whatever it wants.
Yeah. I think a lot of people have this idea that their body is in their control or their health is in their control. And I just think that's like a hilarious farce. And that, you know, if they haven't experienced an uncontrollable body, they will. Or you can't control your body from bodying all over you. But one of the major themes that kind of drew me to you was your explicit writing about dealing with Crohn's and dealing with poop, dealing with all the things that come with having a bowel disease. And I wonder, you know, what does humor give to us in talking about the more kind of taboo things? I mean, first off, why are these things taboo? That's an overarching question, but I feel like what you're doing is chipping away at that taboo to make it really accessible for people to be like, yeah, I mean, everybody poops, not to borrow from the book, but...
Yeah, it's shocking and it will continue to shock me forever. You must do it to stay alive. If you eat food, you have to poop out the waste. Every person, you know, I'm not a zoologist, but I'm going to go ahead and say every animal. Do insects poop? Probably. We all must get rid of our waste. And the idea that that's something you clown someone for. I mean, I had shame around poop, or was shamed around poop, like from an early, early age. And you never consider, at least not when I was younger, of course, you don't consider that the people making fun of you are wrong. Everybody has to do it every day, sometimes multiple times a day. I don't know that everyone gets shamed about poop. But I will say this is a thesis I'm coming up with right now, so it's not gonna sound great.
Hot off the press.
Yes, hot out the butt. I think there is something too about being a fat person with poop problems, because people hate fat people and they do not want to think about fat people eating. So they certainly don't want to think about fat people pooping. It's just like with weight, where people are like, it's your fault you look like that, and it's your fault your butt doesn't work. And I don't, I've never had the experience of being a thin person with Crohn's disease, but I bet if I were like hospital thin, you know, with a with a blog about Crohn's, it wouldn't have to be funny. And the outpouring of love would be overwhelming rather than the like, ew, you wrote about what? So the fact that it's stigmatized in the first place is insane. And then using humor, I mean, it's easy to make jokes about poop, like they're funny.
It's honestly one of the first brands of jokes that we navigate towards as children.
I was with my friend the other day and her kid was with her and he like jumped in her lap and started farting on her. And I laughed. We all laughed. Yeah, it was very funny. I started writing about Crohn's a lot because it made a social life easier. Because, you know, being the person who takes longer or walks slower or needs more or has whatever kind of disability, if the people around you don't, that's rough, especially when you're young, because I have found that young people tend to be a smidge less caring or doting or accommodating than those of us in our 40s. So I'm going to dinners and clubs and all the stuff you do in your 20s and also being like, sorry, I have to have diarrhea at the club. And
that's a good essay, diarrhea at the club.
Sorry, I had diarrhea at the club.
Featuring diarrhea.
But it's like the more I wrote about it, the less I had to say in real life. You know what I'm going through. I don't have to pretend I'm going to check my lipstick or whatever. I can say, hey, y'all, don't do the thing where you wait for me to get back from the bathroom before you order, because I'm going to be gone for 20 minutes. So no one who knew me or even like read something I'd written would not understand the kind of grace I need in social situations. So that was like reason one, was just for myself, very selfishly, to be like, stop pressuring me to go out. I told you I don't feel good. So that's reason number one. And then number two, no pun intended, when I started getting feedback from people who were grateful to see their experience mirrored by someone else. Because that's another thing about IBS in particular. I mean, it's like cute to have t-shirts that are like, hot girls have IBS. I love that. But I don't feel like we talk about that in regular life as much. It is nuts to me that anyone who has bowel problems would feel alone, because so many of us have them, but so many people do because no one talks about it. No one is like, hey, I prolapsed my rectum, not from sex, but from shitting. And it's like, if anyone who feels alone feels a connection with me because of this, then that's golden. Like people say to me at signings or whatever, they'll email me and be like, you know, thank you for talking about this stuff. I feel like I'm on an island. And that's a terrible feeling that no one should have, but certainly not over a bodily function we are literally required to participate in.
Yeah, it's impossible for me to not think about my own experiences in this context. I drained bile out of my body every night for basically 11 years. I had bile bags, and I think I went to sixth grade with bile bags, actively draining bile out of my body the whole time I was in middle school, and I would empty out the bags. Thank God we were in sixth grade and no one really was paying that much attention. But I had these like little jean purses that my friend's mom made me. I know, it's tender. I like really feel for that 12-year-old.
Yeah, me too. I wish I could hug her.
Yeah, totally. But I think part of the difficulty was that it, you know, like poop things, right? Like bile makes your, that's what makes your poop brown and smelly. Like that's the substance, baby. And so,
yeah.
Oh my gosh. I had some problems where I would like have my tube would be leaking and I'd be like in Nordstrom shopping and bile just be pouring down my body, you know, but I think all of the experiences that you write about, even if it's like a different kind of thing, it's very similar, right? Shame and humiliation of having kind of these bodily fluids come out of you.
And people jumping back from you, like people like flinching away from you as if they don't have the exact same stuff in their body. Like, what do you think your intestines are doing right now? Like whistling? No, they're making poop.
I remember my freshman year roommate of college called me a biohazard. That was a really fun experience. We got over it. We did. We did.
You continue. Horrible. You had to live with this person?
For sure. For sure. For sure I did. But you know.
Where is she now? Hopefully not successful and in a ditch.
I don't know, actually. I don't know. We kind of lost touch, but.
Good. Sounds like a terrible fucking person.
I think, you know, the thing to me, though, that you point out so poignantly is we all have these things.
Yeah.
And they're on a spectrum for sure, right? But like, I mean, you can't tell me that any person with ovaries and a uterus hasn't had some kind of accident in menstruation. Like,
yes,
that we haven't had these significant experiences that are humbling.
If I saw somebody bleeding vaginally in public, I would not be like, oh my God, look at that horrible thing that's happening.
No, you'd be like,
I would be like, can I help you?
Yeah,
that has happened to me.
Totally.
Nobody helped me. Can I do anything for you? Do you want this hoodie to wrap around your butt or whatever it is? The lack of empathy and understanding right now is so bananas to me because we truly are separating ourselves from people who have the same thing going on that we do. You know, an alien didn't pop out of her butt, just a little period blood. It's okay. You can show her compassion.
Absolutely. I do want to touch briefly on your new book, Quietly Hostile.
Yes.
It just came out, for those who are wondering. And it's another essay collection. It touches on mental health, aging, finding success, pooping in public. I completely agree. Just sit on the public toilet sometimes. Damn it.
Just sit. Just sit. Maybe there is a study somewhere that's like someone caught a something through their butt skin from a public toilet seat. But come on. Come on.
I love that. Much of your essay collection was written during the pandemic, which you address as the last normal day. The pandemic was decidedly obviously not funny in a lot of ways. How did you approach writing about it in an entertaining way? Because I think that's hard to do, especially now.
So I, knock wood again, still have not caught COVID.
Okay. Blessings for you. Maybe you're one of the immune ones. Maybe you had it in low dose and your immune system, I don't know. You know what? It's probably not it.
I just didn't really go outside. I didn't go anywhere. I was like in the house for a year minimum.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, people like us can't risk it. If you have health stuff.
Immunosuppressed girlies.
I get into this in the book, how like obnoxious this was. But the news would literally be like, fat people, you're gonna die. And it's like, well, okay, bitch, I will stay my fat ass in the house, I guess. So it was, in the beginning, it was like, I don't want to catch this thing that will clearly kill me. So I was like locked in the house. Luckily, I got to work during the pandemic on Zoom. So there were things to do. Mm. And that gives me things to write about.
Was this a lot of the writing for the shows? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I worked on Tuca and Birdie. And then Just Like That, those were both Zoom rooms. So that was good for my brain, but also for material to write about. And then one of the essays in the book is about how I got really into QVC, which felt like a natural thing to get into during the pandemic.
Of course.
But I just was thinking about what is happening in my life right now, right? We got a dog. I wrote about that. I worked on it Just Like That, wrote about that, like the very specific things. And then it was just like, well, what am I thinking about and what's funny? So I wrote a thing about how I love chain restaurants and everyone shits on them, even though they are all consistent and good. I wrote about this nun porn that I like to watch. It was truly like me looking around and being like, what do I care about? Oh, this? Okay, I'll write about it.
Have you found that, you know, now as your life gets a little bit more sexy, if you will, in writing for television, that is kind of, you know, your best-selling author, that it feel, is it harder to write about those things than the kind of more seemingly mundane or even harder parts of your life? Like, is it hard to write about those in funny ways, or do you find you can apply the same level of humor analysis?
That's a great question. The tough thing is that these are my coworkers who I hope to continue to work with. So, like, within Just Like That, I wanted to write about the show, but I'm not trying to piss off Cynthia Nixon, right? Or Sarah Jessica Parker or any of my coworkers. Also, like, the working on that job was amazing. And the show's not done. One of the tenets of my writing is I try not to write about anything that's ongoing or that anything where I can't land the plane definitively. That's why I didn't write about the OCD in this book, because I don't know what to say about it yet. You know, yeah. I've been on Zoloft for under a year. I'm still in therapy. What can I say? I could just write a bunch of confusion. And mm-hmm. So with And Just Like That, I knew I wanted to write about it, mostly because I wanted to complain in public that people had sent me hilarious death threats. And then I was just like, okay, I want to write about this, but I don't want to write about the show. We're going to get another season. I need to stay employed at this easy job I know how to do by this point. And it was like, okay, so what I can do with this is talk shit about the first iteration of the show. Or, you know, some lady had told me that she, in one of my death threats, she was like, if you bring Aiden back, I will kill you, or something like that. And it's like, well, first of all, ma'am, I am the last one on the call sheet.
Yeah, you're like, I'm not making those kind of decisions.
Yeah, I'm like, you better call Mr. HBO because I don't get to.
Don't put my life on the chopping block. You got the wrong guy.
I don't get to decide that. And so I got all these, you know, like weird mail about emasculating men and ruining the original series. And I was like, okay, I will ruin the original series in a real way. And so I wrote, you know, just kind of like a jokey list of all the shit I would do to fuck up the first show. For me, I always like to kind of go back a little and write about a thing that's already been settled. I usually don't write about it or write about anything that I'm currently grappling with and don't know what I'm going to do, only because when you write a book, people talk to you about your book, right? And I can't sit through 20 interviews going, well, I know I wrote about that, but I don't want to talk about it.
Right.
Because that's not fair.
Yeah.
That's you know, not or fair. At a book reading, if somebody's like, oh, hey, this part meant so much to me. I want to talk to you about it. I'm like, I will not be the person who's like, sorry, no, I don't feel good talking about that. I don't want to shut anyone down. I don't put anything in a book that I couldn't like stomach seeing on the news, because essentially for the rest of your life, if you tell someone you wrote a book, they will talk to you about that book. And I don't think it's fair to the reader to then be like, well, I know I wrote about it in minute detail, but I'm not going to talk to you about it. Like, that feels, that's not the kind of person I want to be.
Fair. I think that's a good thing. I really do. Well, Sam, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you. I love your work. I love what you represent. I love what you're doing in the world. And just keep doing it. Keep doing it for yourself and for all of us.
I will. I promise. I will. I signed a 3-book deal. So this one is the first in that deal. So I'm on the hook for 2 more minimum.
I love that for me and I love that for you.
Thank you. But it is structured so that if I don't have any ideas or can't do it, I don't get any penalty. But the flip side of that is they don't pay you.
The penalty is the no money thing. But, yeah. Come hell or high water, I will get ideas out of me.
That's right. I got a mortgage to pay.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, there's going to be a couple more. Don't worry. I'll be back.
I'd love to hear it. I feel, yeah, we'll do this again the next time.
Yes. Anytime. This was great. I mean, guaranteed there will be, I will keep pooping and there will be more poop to write about.
More stories. Good, good, good. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This was really great.
Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to United Bodies wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, it would be so helpful to us if you would rate and review the show. That helps more people like you find us. We'll be back next week with more. United Bodies is a Ms. Magazine and Ms. Studios production. The show is created and produced by me, Kendall Seismeyer. Michelle Goodwin is our executive producer.